a bigger issue. We established a coastal field office to handle our coastal processes and hazards, which has become a very big issue. And in 2003, our governing board adopted a revised strategic plan, which identified groundwater resources as one of the primary strategic areas for our agency. And so we work a lot with our mapping toward the groundwater resources. Go to page 2, talking about our mission. Within our mission, which is essentially to provide for the health, safety, and welfare of Oregonians with our geologic information, we have three core strategies from our strategic plan. It's our geologic information. So that's the science of geology. That's that mapping that we go out and do. That's the geological hazards that we're dealing with identifying and characterizing. We have resource management, which, again, that is looking at mineral resources and how do you both manage the operation and the permitting and the reclamation of that in a way that's proactive and works best for the safety of the operation and for the folks that are around them. And very importantly is community education. You have all this great information that we glean. Well, it doesn't do anyone any good if we can't package it in a way that's useful to the people that need that information. So our community education, it really goes across all or most of our programs and projects. Page 3, we've taken those core strategies and we've turned them into 5 goals, or in the performance measure lingo, 5 high-level outcomes. And so I'll be referring back to these goals as we go through this, particularly when we get to the performance measures. Our goal 1 is just reduce risk to the Oregon communities from geological hazards. Very straightforward. We're out there working very hard to identify those problem areas and to work on those. Goal 2 is to improve public awareness of geologic hazards and educate communities on the mitigation. Again, doesn't do any good to get the information if you're not getting it to the people who need it. Those are both under our program 1. Goal 3 is our resource management, and we say resource management via prompt reclamation of acres disturbed. Well, you can't reclaim if you're not doing the front end part of the work, which is that you're also working very hard on the permitting and the operation. So it goes hand in hand, both regulation for permitting as well as the reclamation.
A little later on those reclamation, can you give us some information as to how you calculate the costs and the upfront dollars that they have to have in place, and does it vary from size to size or with the different types of operations, you know, in-stream, private property, whatever?
Okay, this calculation for the reclamation bonding. Okay, if I don't, I'll know who to ask. Goal 4 is that compilation of geologic data. Again, that's going out and either creating new geologic data via mapping or other geological science, or compiling what information's already out there. We're big on not trying to be redundant on things. So if there's good information there, we go and get it and then use it for ourselves. And goal 5 is, again, that community part, is how do you get that information out to the people who need it so it's useful for policy decisions, for land use decisions, for the usefulness. So, again, goals 1, 2, 4, and 5 are essentially described under our program 1, which is the geologic survey and services. Goal 3 is for our second program, which is what we call MLRR, the regulation and reclamation. Page 4, you have the department overview. We fit within the governor's principles under livability and the environment, and that's really how we look at the service that we provide. We provide for the best and safest places for Oregonians to work and play and live, and we ensure that our geologic environment stays viable and healthy. So that's the long-winded way of saying what he said in one sentence. We do that via 2 programs. We have, again, the program 1 is our survey and services. That's the science of geology, social applications, public policy. How do we develop and sustain the natural resource, the geologic natural resource?
On the social application, sharing your information with schools and stuff?
Part of what we call community education, which is a very broad umbrella and covers everything from how we publish, whether we're publishing professional papers, whether we're having workshops, whether we help schools with developing curriculum for, say, earthquake safety and for tsunami safety. And so we do not have the resources to hit every school, but we, if the schools come to us and they're interested, then we help them with that.
You have a wealth of information, and kids love rocks and stuff. Do schools take advantage? Do you think that our school system takes as much advantage of your what you have to offer it than, or should they be doing more of it?
Well, I think what you find is usually is you have. Reminded that I'm forgetting my formalities here. Mr. Chair and Representative Scheffler, we do have a wealth of information. Many of the schools use us very proactively. Some of them not as much. The kind of the communication lack comes from a couple of things. Again, we don't have a huge staff where we can go out and hit them all. And some schools have different focuses than others. And so we try to work on that as much as we can. You know. Good question, though. Thank you. And then Program 2, again, is our lead regulatory agency for permitting solid and fluid minerals. And right now that is primarily in the aggregate sector, although we do have some industrial. Page 5 is, I just threw this in. This is just a little because we're looking at what's happening over the last 10 years. I just bring your attention to the fact that we have had relatively flat FTEs. We keep ourselves pretty lean. That's not exactly the same as how it's been in the rest of the state. And so I do want you to know, though, we do have about 41 folks employed right now, and those other folks are temps and LDs, and they're project-driven. We are very project-oriented right now, and if we have projects that need extra people to get the job done on time, then we go out and we bring in temps or limited-duration folks to do that. Page 6 gives you an idea. It gives you our organizational chart. Very straightforward, although I am going to make a couple of points on this. Program 1, the survey and services. Both of our programs maintain a strong field presence, and it's reflected in the way we have our organization here. If you notice in Program 1, we have an Eastern Oregon section. Well, we have a little field office in Baker City. We have a Southwest Oregon section. We have another modest field office in Grants Pass. These have been there. They're sites that have been there since the beginning of the agency in those locations. As we said in the late 1999, we asked for and got permission to start a coastal field office. We now have a Newport office, a little modest office over there. We maintain that those are extremely important to have people in the field near where the issues are and not everyone sitting in Portland, which is where our main administrative offices are, and trying to send people out. Our main office in Portland has our core mapping and our geohazard section. Our PubEd section is there because that's where we have our cartographers and our folks that deal with publications. And that's where our internal services, so our accountant and our business officer and those folks are there. Now, the PubEd section and internal services, even though they're in that Program 1, they really provide services as well for Program 2, particularly the internal services. Program 2 is located out of our Albany office. That's our, again, the Mineral Land Regulation and Reclamation Office. Those are our professional reclamationists that, again, they're mostly geologists and hydrologists, and they're, again, very field-oriented, and they're dealing with those folks that are out there that are in the mineral extraction business. The next one I put in because I just think it makes everyone nice and confused, but the idea is that we have both geologic processes are integrated. You don't deal with earthquakes without having to deal with the other resources or the hazards that go along with it. And we really, and our agency, are very integrated in the same way. Our internal services, as I said, are agency-wide. PubEd staff are really integral to most or all of our projects and are service-oriented to the agency, and we're very field-based to meet those regional needs. So I'm going to go, and I'm going to quickly go through both the programs, some of the things that we do based on those five goals that we have. So it rolls into the performance measures a little bit. So in program one, the first goal is that reduce risk to Oregonians. And I want to say I'm proud to say that there's a lot of geological hazards out there, but because Oregon is what it is, a very dynamic state geologically, there are a lot of things that we have to look for. And I know we just saw a great example of it the other day with Mount St. Helens again. And I brought one of the earlier pictures from Mount St. Helens. That's not from the last one. The issues with tsunamis and with coastal erosion, with landslides. I mean, we have all of those. They're part of what make the state so attractive, but they're also what we have to be aware of, and we have to try to educate people on those. And so we work hard at that. I won't go through the whole slew of them that we have there. If you go to the next page, we have a very diverse group of projects and activities. We're doing mapping that's dealing with hazards mapping. We have pre-disaster and hazard mitigation studies that are going on. We have very specific coastal studies that are looking at coastal erosion and coastal hazards. And I would just like to draw your attention to the fact, if you look at this whole list that's here, in parentheses you see a list of what we call our partner agencies. And these may be either who are partnering and funding us, but we're also providing them with vital information, or they're partners of who are going to use that information if it's at a county or a city level. So we're very happy about having these partnership availabilities, and we think that that's very important because we're not just developing a bunch of information that no one's using. There's people that want that information.
The Johnson Creek lands, where is that at? Johnson Creek lands.
Mr. Chair, Representative Shoffler, that Johnson Creek landslide is out on the coast, and it's north of
Okay.
There's a Johnson Creek's like Rock Creek and Deer Creek.
Okay, all right.
There's 30 of them.
Yeah, so that particular one, and it's been a thorn in ODOT and Highway 101 site ever since they built it. So in that particular case, what we've done is we have a 5-year study on that landslide where we have it, we've cored it so that we understand what all the geology is of the slide, of both on it and above it. And we now have a series of monitoring equipment in it, inclinometers and dilatometers, that measure its movement over time. And that's with ODOT. Goes for 5 years, and so it's a tremendous amount of information on how these coastal slides operate. For that first goal, we have four performance measures I'll be talking about in a little bit. Just wanted to get you ready for these. And that's our key performance measures, 1 through 4. Those all roll up in the Oregon Benchmark 67A, and I'll explain that in a little more detail when we get to that part. Okay, the geologic survey goal 2, again, it's that awareness. It's not enough just to ID and map and characterize. You've got to get the information out there. So we have a variety of venues for doing that. And if you'll see on page 12, there's some of the recent and ongoing activities for that. We conduct workshops, and we usually partner with other state agencies for that, for specific information. We have awareness programs for certain hazards. We have staffed and hosted task force on certain hazards, and we do a lot in that last one, the Lakeview Earthquakes Public Meeting and Astoria Landslide Meeting. Those are our toughest ones to make because those are the things that happen. Lakeview, here's a little town in the, down in the south central part of the state. They've had earthquake swarms now for over 9 months, enough to where they've actually caused some minor damage in town. Well, this is not really an area that we watch a lot for earthquakes, and so when this started occurring, you can imagine there were a few people wondering what was going on. So they contact us, ask if we can go out and have a look around, have a public meeting, talk about that. Well, that means we pull someone off of a project and ask them to go do that. But we can't not say that because that's what we're here for. I mean, that's why we're important to the state. So we did that, of course. And they had about 50 people at the public meeting, which is huge for Lakeview.
Can you talk to us a little bit about the workshop that you were on the tsunami issue with the coastal people here, what, 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago? How you participated in that, and
great.
Maybe some of the things that you think might be coming out of that.
Thank you, Chair and Committee Member. And I didn't bring that one up because it's toward the end of the time, but yes, we co-sponsored with DLCD and OEM, Office of Emergency Management, for a tsunami workshop. It was over a day and a half, and it was really asking the local emergency responders and emergency managers, what do they see are the gaps, or what do they see as their needs for dealing with this type of hazard, with the tsunami hazard? And our part of that was primarily to bring the information, to educate them on what the hazard is, what does it look like, what does it taste like, what does it feel like, how would you go through the scenario of looking at what you have or don't have. We had a great response. Very good information came out of that, and there will be a tsunami summit where we bring that information to the legislature and to the governor. That's to occur on April 7th in Hearing Room E, I believe, 3:30 to 5. Moving on, page 13, our key performance measure for our educational aspect of hazards is performance measure 5, and that does, again, roll up into 67A. Now we're going to skip goal 3 because that will be when I talk about program 2. Goal 4 is our compile and create geologic data. Again, that's some of our mapping exercises, some of the very specialty kind of digital data that we collect and compile, and some of the imagery that we're collecting and compiling. And I have an example of what's called LIDAR imagery over here, if you get a chance to take a look at it. It's quite interesting. If you go to page 15, some of the activity we're doing with that, of course, we have high-resolution mapping, which is quadrangle 1 to 24,000 mapping, and we have a variety of areas that we're either mapping for urban or for basin studies, water studies. We have very specific projects.
Is that the LIDAR information, is that available on the Internet? Is that stuff? Can you download that stuff?
Chair Krieger, Representative Schaffler, it is not available right now. It will be. What we're doing right now is we are finishing up this information with our U.S. Geological Survey partner, and it's just he it hasn't been completed yet. But yes, it will eventually be available. And again, page 16, I'll just go on to our key performance measures for our mapping, for those goals with the mapping. We have three. These are our internal performance measures. We have a performance measure for high resolution, that's the quadrangle mapping, medium resolution, which are the compilations, the 1 to 100,000 mapping, and then we have a performance measure to track how we're doing with regional resource assessments that we have completed. That also resource assessments include watershed and water studies, the groundwater studies. Next one is a survey goal 5. Again, it's bringing that information in some type of a way that it's useful to the people who need it. And we have, a variety of delivery venues. If you look on page 18, you'll see a few of those. We have a large digital geologic map project going on. That's a six-year project. Yes?
Back up a minute. You mentioned watershed mapping and geologics. I missed that map there, but how do you work there with water resources and OWEB? And how much overlay or overlap is there of the things you do, and how do you share information or get it from one agency to the other?
Thank you, Chair Krieger and committee members. That's a great question, and I didn't mean to brush over it, but they're actually some of our largest partners, both in where we map and in some of the funding that we receive as well, both the state water resources and the federal water resources. And so we're looking at their basin studies. We compile the geologic data, both surface and subsurface, in a format, these 1 to 100,000 maps. That's these data are turned over to them. They're the ones that do the ground, the aquifer modeling. That's not our job. But they need our information to be able to do what they do.
All right. Thank you.
Again, on page 18, it just gives an example of some of the delivery systems we have. We have Nature of the Northwest, publication sales, an information center, resource libraries, and, of course, our department website and links from there. We have one performance measure for that, which is geologic data used in local policy making. How can we improve on this? Well, we have a couple of things we're doing, and this sounds geeky. I'm just going to go over it quickly, but we're fully integrating digital mapping, map making, and publications and map dissemination into seamless GIS layers. And the bottom line is there is we are moving into the web delivery and into the geographic information system world, and that's how we will be both creating our maps and delivering them. And eventually what we have in mind is to have self-service online map generation. That's down the line, but that is one of our far-reaching goals for delivery. We're always looking to expand our county and community partnerships because they're some of the most important agencies that we work with. And, of course, we're always looking to either build new or increase our partnerships with our federal partners. Okay.
Thank you. The, I imagine in the past you had to charge for map. It cost some money to produce it. And with all this going online, will you lose some revenue because of that?
Chair Krieger, Representative Scheffler, that's a very good question, and yes, we will. We are charged with recouping some of the costs for our creation and publication of a map. We are not really allowed to make money on that particularly, and so by going into a different venue, it does change how the money will be exchanged, shall we say. But we're looking at other ways of being able to recoup those costs. One of the things we're looking at is maybe you would have to subscribe to that part of the web to be able to download and build those maps. And, a minor subscription amount is something that we're looking at. There are other venues of doing that. I mean, we understand that we still, it's important to have this public information out there. It's important to get it out in a way that's useful. But we do have to always look at how to recoup at least the costs of producing the material. If you go to page 21, we'll talk about Program 2, which is MLRR, our Mineral Land Regulation and Reclamation, whose primary goal is the Goal 3. It only looks like one goal, but it's a lot. That's resource management. And again, it's through prompt reclamation of acres disturbed during exploration or mining of fluid, exploration or mining or fluid mineral drilling and secure bonding. And so we'll talk a little bit about your question about the bonding.
Thank you. I'm still a little kid. I'm fascinated with this stuff, so forgive me for asking all these questions. Oil and gas, do we have much or any of that around here?
Chair Krieger, board members, we have a modest gas field, the Mist gas field, that's up in the northeast part of the state. It is there's still a few producing wells there. I believe it's maybe six or seven from the field. Most of the field's being used for storage right now. So that is the only producing field we have. Now, there's been exploration in several other of the basins across the state, but there hasn't been anything really that has been. When you look at other, we're competing against areas either nationwide or worldwide where the resource is much, much larger, and so there hasn't been as much interest in that. We do have a little bit of exploration work that's going on right now in the Coos Bay area looking at coal bed methane extraction. And so that's some minor work that's going on out there right now.
Welcome, Senator Nelson. We're on about page, 21?
21. We're on page 21 right now.
You mentioned the word storage. Tell us what happens there.
Well, the the wells are used to store gas that's brought in from somewhere else.
How much that do you lose? You put so many cubic feet in the ground, how much do you get back out of it? Is there a loss?
Representative Krieger, absolutely there's a loss. I really couldn't give you what the amounts are. I don't know, Gary, if you have any idea on that. It's certainly they're not losing enough that they'd want to store it somewhere else. So it must still...
Keep way to store it.
Exactly.
Okay, just kind of wondering.
And we are on page 21. We've gone through the overview for Program 1, and we're talking about overview for Program 2 right now. And Program 2 is our mineral land regulation and reclamation. And we have several primary project areas within that. I'll go into a couple of these, and then I will ask Gary to come up, if he would, and talk a little bit about the reclamation and bonding. Program 2 is fee-based. So that's quite different. Program 1 is other fund, federal fund, and general fund based, but Program 2 is fee based. So I want to make that, distinction before. Some of the primary work goes for aggregate and industrial minerals production and operation. So it's regulation of the surface mining that's going on. That is primarily, as we said, in the aggregate minerals, and there are some industrial minerals production that we regulate operation and permitting of right now. We also, as we said, regulate oil, gas, and geothermal exploration and production. There's very little, as we said, very little of that going on. We have about a half of FTE that's dedicated to that right now. And as we said, that's matching the revenue and the workload. And again, those are fee-based. We have a non-regulatory, stakeholder-driven program. It's called our Mine Land Restoration Program. And that one is really dealing with what we call the pre-law or relic mine sites. Those are sites that were grandfathered in before some of the reclamation laws came on board, or relic sites that are no longer operating at all but are still out there as a non-reclaimed mineral site or quarry or mine site. In some cases, not all, but in some cases, the location of those sites puts them in an area that may have the potential to cause other damage, particularly if they happen to be in a floodplain area or around wetlands in those. And so we have based this program on the restoration program on identifying these potential areas and building a stakeholder base to be able to deal with fixing them. We also have a Mine Land Reclamation Award. This is another non-regulatory program that recognizes the incentive of the industry for going out to above and beyond what they're really required to do and showing initiative, and we think that's very important. That's on page 22. And we have a partnership with DEQ for streamlining part of their stormwater program. And so the areas that we already are permit or regulate, we contract with DEQ to operate their stormwater permitting as well. And that just cuts down on streamlines a little bit. So if you would, I'll ask Gary Lynch to talk a little bit about the reclamation bonding at this point. If you would, Gary, please.
For the record, I'm Gary Lynch with the Assistant Director of Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. And we just were sitting back there. There's an important correction we want to make here that Rich Engstrom, I'm sure, would like me to make. And that is on page 21, the aggregate industry is a $250 million, not $2.5 million industry with a conservative multiplier of 2. So, and that $250 million is product at the mine mouth, which means raw product that from there goes off to all its many uses. Chair Krieger, the answer to the how do we calculate bonds, it's been frankly a torturous history as to how that started. With initially it was capped with, we had certain levels at which we couldn't exceed. Ultimately, over the course of the last 10 years particularly, the bonding regulation has, and we've worked with the industry on this, bonds are calculated to figure out the actual cost of reclamation. And it's been problematic, particularly for smaller operators, because the bonds too typically get large on this. And the insurance industry, understandably so, gives a very good rate to the Morse brothers and the larger operators in the state, and again, understandably so. The smaller operators that don't have the wherewithal to deal with this issue sometimes get rates that make it, at times, it can make it prohibitive for them to continue their operation. This was a result of that perplexity last time, gave us the opportunity to look at establishing a statewide bond pool. We did an awful lot of work with the Insurance Commission and others in the interim, and we're that far away from being competitive, but we needed about a subscribership, if my numbers are right, of about, we currently have a bond load of about $21 million statewide for these sites. We needed $7 million of that to come over to be into the statewide bond pool, and we got about, based on doing talking with operators and sending out notices and stuff, we could only come up with about $2 to $3 million worth of subscribership. And I know we're close, but we're not quite there yet. And I know for the competitiveness of this industry, to frankly, while we need the large and important members that are represented by OCAPA, and I know Rich would say the same thing, in rural Oregon, we have to preserve some of these smaller operators.
Give us some figures, Gary, about. Yeah. What are you talking about? You know, you're telling us, give us some figures what a small operation, what you might say a small operation is, and then what would type of a bond would they have to put up?
Chair Krieger, a small operator might be, we'll toss it out at 10 acres. It might produce anywhere from 5,000 yards a year to 50,000 yards a year. The bond on that site, and it's calculated on what it's going to cost, and we use the industry handbook, so it's very much a computerized form that you fill out, and it's well documented in terms of ground truth of what these costs are to backfill, bring material in, reseed, recontour, revegetate, to bring it back to the secondary beneficial use that the county establishes. A bond on a site like that could range anywhere from, say, and these are, you know, a swag, scientific version of a wild guess, $10,000 to $50,000 for a site like that.
Is that a one-time thing on that site until you're done, then you actually do the work?
The bond is calculated based on the site itself, so at any in its life through the mine cycle. So early on, it tends to be the bond stent continually goes up as the size of the disturbance gets greater, and then starts to decrease as the size gets smaller. So we have the ability to change those bonds on a regular basis at the request of the operator. But the difficulty is the smaller operators may be paying $2, $3, $4 or more dollars per thousand, whereas some of the larger operators are paying cents per $1,000 of bond obligation. So it's difficult on the smaller, and it's recognized. We are pulling our hair out trying to figure out how to solve this issue. And I'll be very upfront. We have a couple of operators right now where we don't have the bond in. We're trying to let them operate, but it puts us in a horrible position.
I want to make sure we had a record. I know it wasn't a problem.
Yeah.
Right. And the land use part of it, where are y'all at on that? If you don't want to talk about it.
No, I'm Chair Krieger and Representative Schaffler are very happy to talk about it, and I don't know how many of you remember House Bill 3013 from last time. The interesting part of that, out of 3013, we did put a consensus group together from the Joint Transportation Committee. Senator Metzger and the governor decided to put some people together to talk about the issue between the agricultural folks and the aggregate folks. And that's really where the land use battle, for the most part, is occurring even today. That consensus group, in fact, we met yesterday or the day before. Certainly the trust between those two industries has dramatically improved. There is maybe not a whole lot of new agreement on how things should be done, but there is a willingness to continue that group through the next interim. There has certainly not been anywhere near the amount of legislation on this issue compared to what we saw last time. So I'd say the consensus group has worked fairly well. The land use issue, particularly as it applies to mining, is always going to be a fairly contentious issue. We need both those products. They're fundamental. The agricultural industry is fundamental to this state, and the aggregate construction industry is fundamental to this state. They're both passionate on both sides of that debate, and we have about, still have 9 miles of muddy road to go on that one.
I was on the conference committee to that bill. And, you know, if I were a small operator, and, you know, you have to deal with that issue, this bonding business, their liability insurance is probably skyrocketing, and price of fuel is probably going to drive. I would just wrap it up and go somewhere, do something else. And I don't know if this will ever happen. I pray to God it doesn't, but if we narrow it down to just a few producers, well, then what happens to the price?
Sure.
Who's going to control the price of that? And who in local government? Government, period, can't afford to buy this stuff at increasing prices. And we've painted ourselves in a corner. I'm preaching now, but we've painted ourselves in a corner here. And we're all using this stuff. And it just really frustrates me. Thank you for indulging me.
Chair Krieger, Representative Schaffler, if I may, I mean, we recognize the importance of this because we have in the MLRR program, which is, as you said, fee-based, about some 400 of our 825 permittees didn't produce any rock last year. They are typically, and this is why we really do believe we are proactive in working with these folks and trying to work whatever it is, bonding or whatever, to keep them alive. And you're actually going to see a fee bill from us that tries to actually decrease the fees on those folks. But what we're facing in this state is we have far more permittees in outside of the Willamette Valley than we do inside it. And so you are right, and I firmly believe that keeping those smaller operators competitive and having them pay their fair share, and I want to compliment OCAPA because I think, and Rich isn't here today, but I know he'll testify sometime, they're aware of this issue as well. And it is a tricky one. I don't have a nice simple answer for everybody on this one, but we do understand that it's very important that Rock and Malheur County be affordable, and frankly, our larger operators aren't going to go looking for to buy operations out in Malheur County or Harney. It's not cost feasible for them. We understand that, but aren't the economies of scale. But interestingly, when we talk about the EFU issue, so much of the land in Eastern Oregon, the EFU land is exclusive farm use only, which is but what 3013 was about. Interestingly, so many times what you have in Eastern Oregon is that little bit of mining activity that goes on that ranch keeps the ranch alive when that road project comes by and they put 50,000 yards, sell 50,000 yards to ODOT. That's $7 a ton. Now they just had a nice little windfall, and that's why they're keeping their permits alive with us. But so it's not going to go. My comment initially to the consensus group was this issue is not going to get easier. We have almost a 1-to-1 correlation between demand for aggregate and population. So as population goes up, so is the demand for aggregate. And
forgive me, Mr. Chair, one more time here. You know, it is easy. You got to dig up some gravel because everybody needs it. And everybody has to accept the fact that they use the resource too. Everybody does. 1,000 Friends, if you're a member of 1,000 Friends, you use aggregate, period. And they have to be reminded of that.
I think you just did. Please continue.
Thank you. Thanks, Gary.
Mr. Chair, I think we're going to end the overview fairly quickly. So
yes, we Chair, we are just about there. I have just a couple other things as we get back into this. And actually, Mr. Lynch covered many of the ways to improve the MLRR, and that's the fee structure adjustment, which we'll talk about in more detail when we come back to visit you folks the next time. We do staff realignments when we have to, and we have a customer service survey that we were asked to perform last time around, and we'll be talking about that in the performance measures. We do have a couple of performance measures for Goal 3, and again, I'm not even going to mention those because we're going to go right into those. So if you go to page 26, I'm going to give you a quick summary of what our key performance measures are, and then we're going to go back and we'll walk through all 11 of those, and we do have requests in for modifications, and I'm going to explain what those modifications are as we go along. Most of them are just redefinitions. They're pretty straightforward. But I'll warn you, we're going to be asking for more rather than less. So we'll see how that works out in the long run. But if on page 26, just go through, we have five key performance measures, number 1 through 5, that roll up into this 67A benchmark, which is the percent of Oregon counties and communities prepared for emergencies or disasters. And our contribution is, of course, preparedness to geological hazards. And you can see the list. Geologic hazards, tsunamis, earthquakes, landslides, and the community education to get that information out to the people who need it. We have five internal, what we call the high-level outcomes. That's measuring our geologic resource management and our mapping, geologic data for local and regional land use and regional problem solving, and then that the regional assessments, and then we also have one again for the community editor outreach, and then that number 11 was the one that we were asked to do, and that was to perform a customer service survey of our regulated community. So I would ask you to turn back to your performance measure tab now.
Mr. Siebert, do we want to have Barbara Seymour come up now before we go start through those, and then she could, if she wants to stay, fine. If she has to leave.
I'm going to stay.
Okay. Why don't you come up, though, and go ahead and give us your little talk and identify yourself, please.
All right. I am. I am Barbara Seymour. I live now in Oceanside, Oregon. I'm originally from Baker County and still part owner of a ranch there out at Haines. I'm a member of the Dogami Board, which is the administrative board, but most of all, I worked over 30 years for the Oregon legislature as the drafter for taxation and state finance. And so I'm totally familiar with the budget crunch that you are in now, and hope it wasn't my fault. But, partially, probably, except that I wasn't the policy maker. That's the only defense I have. But I do want to say to you that this, of all the state agencies, I started out in 1969 actually was my first session drafting. Before that I was a bill indexer with three little children. And I had started out in 1970 as a drafter with legislative counsel and got loaded with the revenue and taxation. In my experience, I have never run into an agency that is harder working or knows how to cooperate and to coordinate and then let go of it, put their best foot forward, spread all the information out, and then let the information be used by people. And I feel that I just feel after now 4 years on the board that they need, and if you could just keep in mind that they need enough general fund seed money so that they can keep operating. And their percentage of general fund money has gone down and down. And what they need is a leverage here. And I would deeply appreciate it if we don't solve our water problems and our mineral problems, then all the human resources and all the education are not going to count for anything. We need to know what we're doing. And I think we need water problem solving in Eastern Oregon. We even need water problem solving in out at the coast with all this dry weather. But it's been beautiful, though, so it's been absolutely wonderful. And that's all I wanted to say. But again, I want to emphasize that you're investing in good people, in good human resources here. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I just make a comment. I mean,
sure.
That was very good testimony. And thank you.
Thank you for hearing me.
The Progress Board has what they call Circle of Prosperity. They've gone into one of our other committees, and they've got this thing going around like this. It's absolutely backwards. It should be going like this. The first thing we ought to be doing is creating opportunities for Oregon. I've heard Representative Schaffer say that. I don't know how many times. We ought to be figuring out how to get jobs. And to me, this agency is, you know, trying to do that. You go out there and as Barbara just said, you see how things work. Then this let them work. So we're looking at it the wrong way. But I appreciate your testimony because it reinforces what I've sort of been developing here.
Continue.
Thank you, Chair Krieger. If you look at page 29, it'll give you an overview of our performance measures, and then we're going to walk through these others, and I promise you we will walk through them at the 50,000 foot level. We had in our 2004 annual report, 8 of our 11 key performance measures met or exceeded the annual targets. And there are very good reasons why we didn't make the ones that we didn't. Revenue shifts have taken us off where we were targeted when we originally wrote these things in 1999. And we had one that was developmental. We conducted a focus group to review our key performance measures during the interim, and that resulted in requests for some modifications we're going to talk about. We want to modify 8, we want to add 4, we want to delete 1. Those have been reviewed by both the Performance Board, the Progress Board, and DAS, and they have been accepted. The modifications have been recommended, so it's now up to everyone in this subcommittee. And we did add our customer satisfaction performance measure as the request of Ways and Means 2003, and we're going to recommend that as a permanent addition to our performance measures. So now if you turn back to the performance measures and look at the annual report, what I'm going to do, starting on page 4 of that annual report, it actually starts with the number 1 performance measure. And remember, those tabs got turned around, so... I'm sure you'll be able to tell the performance measures from the prioritization.
Don't count on it.
10% of Oregon cities and towns.
That's it. Percent of Oregon cities and counties. That's our number one performance measure. That is actually the Oregon Benchmark 67A. That's taken straight from its description. And so right now, if you look at where we are, we've fallen a little behind our target data. That's because over the last 3 years, because of the budget shortfalls we had to fund shift for bits or all of our... Shall I wait until everyone gets caught up here?
Yeah.
No problem.
I'm not quite there.
It's a challenge.
Oh, I know. I was thinking, how is the way to get this all packaged one way? And there's just...
I'm fine. Thank you.
You there?
Okay.
Yeah. I'm kind of here.
Great. So we'll go back to this. The first one is the percent of Oregon cities and towns have met community preparedness standards for geologic natural hazards. Again, that is actually the Oregon Benchmark 67A. And right now we're a little below our target. That's because we've had to fund shift some of our professionals that were working on geologic hazards. They've gone on to projects, and some of those projects aren't targeted or goal toward this particular. So we're a little low right now.
Certain cities, because of where they are, would have more risk.
Absolutely.
Do you kind of prioritize those to get them up and running that have more risk, like the coastal community or, you know, whatever?
Chair Krieger, board members, we have a couple of ways that we go about that. One, we have a matrix set up where we have listed the cities that are 5,000 folks or above. That's how our matrix is set up. And then some of the smaller cities we combine with others so that we can make that 5,000 limit. And then we list those geologic hazards, and we assign a numerical value, whether it's high, low, or whether they even have that risk. And from that, that helps us target where we want to work, where we want to target our work toward those urban areas. Now, I have to be frank with you, though. That, again, is limited by where we can find the funds to do the work. We've done a tremendous amount of work on the coast lately because we've been able to pull in more funds for NOAA. In some of the other areas, we haven't been able to pull the funds in, and so they're not getting that equal amount of attention. So we work on that, and we try to target those federal funds that we're looking for to meet what our missions and goals are. But they're not going to be a one-to-one all the time. You have to look for what's reasonably there and what you think you can reasonably bring in. If you go to page 5, what all I'm going to mention here is that we're going to ask to redefine this performance measure. We're going to actually define it as percent of communities and other stakeholders provided with hazard maps and risk studies for earthquakes and landslides, because that's really what our geohazards do, is earthquakes and landslides. We added stakeholders instead of just communities because right now we're doing work for example, the Oregon University system. We have a project with them where we're looking at the vulnerability, seismic vulnerability of the buildings on all the higher ed, on all the Oregon community colleges and colleges. Well, that doesn't fit within our criteria for a community, so we're not being able to count that work within this performance measure.
Mr. Siebert, do you know if the chairs, Oregon and Crop, have gone through those and with you in any manner have any concerns or recommendations that I might not be aware of?
Mr. Chair, I think that generally the co-chair review of the measures thought that the agency had more than enough measures, let's say, and that they were looking for maybe opportunities to reduce the number of measures, including the ones that they wanted to add. So I think that we'll be working with the department before they appear in the next phase to kind of identify some measures that maybe the department could keep internally and to track the kind of issues, because they need to do it for their own management purposes but may not raise to the level of reporting externally to...
Similar to what we've seen in some of the other agencies.
Exactly, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Please continue.
Oh, thank you, Chair Krieger, and thank you, Mr. Siebert. That's a very good point. I think that we're learning, all of us are learning about performance measure reporting and what its importance is as this moves along. So if we look at, okay, I'm quickly go through this. Number 2 is looking at coastal communities with tsunami hazards. Again, we didn't quite make our target, and that was because of these fund shifts, which means we've shifted folks to projects. We're going to be asking that we redefine that performance measure to take out the mitigation plans, because we really don't do mitigation plans for communities and just look at what we do produce, which are the hazard maps. If you move on to number 3, it's percent target communities with landslide or coastal erosion hazards. This we're a little above because of actually having some projects that are working specifically with coastal hazards. We're going to request a redefinition of moving the landslide hazard out of that one and adding it with the number 1, which will be earthquakes and landslides. So it's a redefinition on that.
Mr. Chair, Vicki Wood, so then is this the one you would delete because you're taking it out, or you're just taking out a piece of it and adding it to another?
No, this one's taking out a piece, adding to another one. However, on number 4, which is the communities with earthquake hazards, again, we're a little ahead of that because of some of the work we've been doing, but we would ask to delete that one because it would be defined in Performance Measure 1.
One thing, Vicki, back on 3.
Yes, sir.
Is with landslides, where in the process is the debris flow question that we had that John worked with us back in 97 or 8 after we had some of the fatalities and that?
That's right. Chair Krieger, that's with the 96-97 winters or the storms and the ensuing landslides. We are still working on finishing those maps. We have a preliminary map out. That's IMS 22, However, that is not our completed project. We have been very fortunate this year to be able to work with the U.S. Geological Survey through their landslide hazard program to, again, get some seed money so that we're looking to reinstigating those mapping projects within the next biennium.
I know there was a lot of controversy at the time as to what caused it, what the definitions were, and people were pointing fingers.
For rapidly moving landslides and...
What we were doing is looking for some science to understand. Of course, the prior director, John, had us up and down the creeks and around the mountains to try to do that. But I think everybody learned a lot from it.
Yes. That's, Chair Krieger, I've absolutely heard that from everyone that was on that informational task force with John Beaulieu, our former director, that they really, really learned about landslides. Hope you didn't cause any while you guys were out there, by the way. But we are still working on that. One of the things was we needed to really get with the communities. We had a hard time hitting all the communities, and we're working very hard at that right now. If we go on to key performance measure 5, this is again the how to measure, how are we hitting that public education part. This was developmental. We've got our description for that now. This is a new performance measure. We're tracking ahead of where we thought we would be. What we're doing is measuring how many times we are contacted by the media when we have a geological event occur. And in this case, in the last year, we had 19 major geologic events that occurred in Oregon during the fiscal year, and the media contacted us on 18 of those events.
You're not saying that 95% of the time people understand?
No.
So I look at the performance measure.
Public awareness?
Yeah. Maybe that's one that you could mark something down to reword it. I think it has value, but go through it with Representative Kropp and Representative Morgan.
Okay. Thank you. And it is. It's been a little frustrating for the public education part is how do you get some kind of quantifiable information as to whether it's successful. For our key performance measure 6, which is for our MLRR program, there are two parts of that. What we've been doing is trying to get a handle on how successful we are on reclaiming land, and that's difficult to do because I have to remind you that reclamation is really dependent on what production is doing. So if you have good production, then you're going to have less reclamation, and you may have, if production's down, you may have more things being reclaimed. So measuring a percentage we felt wasn't a good way of measuring if that was successful or not. So we are going to change that to, we'd like to change that to total number of mining acres that have been reclaimed and returned. So we're simply counting the data of how much has been reclaimed and returned, not trying to do a percentage comparing to what's in production and what's being reclaimed. Does that make
sense to me? Don't you have a problem with the fact you've got a lot of old mines out there? You don't know who the owners are. How does that all play into this?
Chair Krieger, Senator Nelson, that's a different issue altogether. When it comes to what we call the relic mines, those are the ones that are maybe abandoned long before we had a reclamation program. We have a restoration program that we try to work on ones that may have hot button issues, but this reclamation is simply for those active mines or quarries that are active now and are under the reclamation.
Active mines.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Vicki, maybe you could go in a little bit about how you interact with the Department of Environmental Quality on abandoned mines, because I know that we had some questions that the committee did about their abandoned mine program, kind of the orphan site mm-hmm. program, and what role you play and where the interaction is between the two agencies.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Siebert. Again, I think I'll ask Gary, because that's on and on again and off again, as I understood it.
We brought up the mercury issue a couple times when we talked to them. It came up.
Yes.
With Stephen Halleck.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, again, I'm Gary Lynch, the Oregon Department of Geology Assistant Director. And the abandoned mine land issue, and it's in this case, we're mainly dealing with abandoned metal mines, mineral mines from turn of the century earlier type stuff, and the problem that Oregon faces with those. And Vicki characterized it as kind of on again, off again anymore as a result of funding. Initially, we were getting grants from EPA and the Forest Service to fund our input into that discussion. Those dried up. While we had that going, we formed an interagency work group. And so we still have that skeleton in place. We don't have a lot of funding to deal with this issue anymore, but we are still working with DEQ, particularly on the mercury issue, because this is a mercury-rich state, like it or not. And in fact, we've just had recent comments into the TMDL process on this, because you could clean up all the abandoned mine lands in that all the former mercury mines in the state, and you're still going to have an issue with mercury, because
it's a natural occurring thing that moved through the system before we were here.
Well, and not only that, it still exists, it's still here.
Yeah.
And it goes from the liquid to gaseous state very easily. And we have a much more what's called reactive gaseous mercury in the system than we probably initially ever believed. And it's a very, very complicated. The fate of mercury in the environment is a very complicated issue. And I know, you know, a bunch of agencies are working on that. I know forestry and us have commented to DEQ on that. So there is still some amount of inertia left over from the interagency work group on abandoned mines, even though it's not funded as well as it used to be from the federal side. So it still exists.
Some of those mines, Gary, are on federal land.
Correct.
They don't have a program that they specifically work with, but it's administered through you and DEQ?
Chair Krieger, the federal agencies typically have their own abandoned mine land programs. The issue for the state is that so often, because of the nature of how those mines evolved, whereas are people familiar with the patenting process, that basically if you mined federal land for long enough and you could prove there was a claim, that land became yours. It became private land. So we now have a situation where we have private land that used to be federal land but was mined right next to federal land. And so who cleans that up? And that's part of the issue. We have abandoned mines both on private lands and federal lands, and they may be right next to each other. And why would we want two independent efforts to go in there, one on one side of the boundary and one on the other? And our goal is to integrate those, and that's what the Interagency Mine Group was doing. We had BLM, EPA, Forest Service, DEQ, Doug Ammi. Those were the key players.
Okay.
The feds stopped coughing up the money that we needed for that. And in fairness, we are in our program, we're mainly funded by the aggregate industry, and the aggregate industry said, well, we're really not paying for abandoned metal mines. We don't think that's a good idea. Don't blame them.
Glasses from one of the old miners.
This cost me a dollar.
And for the record, I think he has 5,000 pairs of them.
It seemed to me a couple of years ago he had some multi-colored color squads. All right, thank you. Let's move ahead here.
Right. Thank you. Chair Krieger and committee members. Moving on, percent number 7, which is the percent. We're now moving on to looking at our mapping, our geologic mapping performance measures, and number 7 is high resolution mapping that we've published. That's our 1 to 24,000 quad geologic mapping. We're currently meeting those targets because we have a strategy that we're basing most of our work on areas of population density or proximity to urban growth boundary. We would like to redefine that a little bit to say percent of quadrangles proposed for mapping as components of medium resolution maps completed over a 3-year period. The issue here being the way we have it now, we're saying which ones have we actually published. Many of these high resolution maps get rolled into a compilation map. They don't get published in a reasonably quick time because they're going to be put in another publication, yet we can't claim that we've done anything with them. So we just want a redefinition there, straighten up how we're doing this. Number 8 is the percent medium resolution, which is our 1 to 100,000 compilation type maps. Again, we are on target, a little above target on that, because we've had some very aggressive compilation mapping projects going on. Our issue with this one is we have a new compilation project that's a six-year project going on right now, and we have no way to measure any progress on it. So we'd like to redefine this to be able to measure that.
Reverend Schaffer.
And this is the subject matter, not the performance measure. I'm sorry. But when you when I go backpacking, I get a topographical map with an overlay of the trails. Does the Forestry Department, I think that's who puts that up, do they come to get the topographical information from you? Or is that U.S. Geological
Chair Survey? Krieger, Representative Schaffler, that's the USGS topographic map program. Yes, those basic topo maps come from the U.S. Geological Survey. Our number nine, which is on page 22 of the performance measures, regional resource assessments completed. And by that, what you're looking at there is simply one of those resource assessments in the chart. We actually measure geology for groundwater, sand and gravel commodity, industrial minerals, precious minerals. There's a variety of resource assessments that we may or may not be working on. What we have found that these are long-term projects. It's hard to measure them on a yearly basis. What we're asking permission to be able to do is to say that we want to redefine the performance measure to say the percent request for mineral information where our staff was able to provide data for what that mineral resource. In other words, do we have the information that the stakeholders are asking us for? And that tells us whether we're actually doing the kind of resource assessment work we should be doing or not. So it's more straightforward, letting them tell us, or letting the stakeholders drive where the projects go.
This information, if a community needed some gravel, and I understand some people come in and say, well, there's not enough on there to justify mining it out. Is this the kind of information they would need to be able to make that? To say, no, there's X amount, X yards of gravel under here. It's worthwhile making this investment, making this decision.
Chair Krieger, Representative Schaffler, they could find it on a general basis. When we map, the most detail we generally map is what we call the quadrangle map, the 1 to 24,000. If there's an area, as you're describing, what we would expect is they would go to the private sector, they would hire a geotech consultant, or they'd hire someone to do a site-specific study, and we're not in that business. Performance measure 10 is it's been developmental. Again, it's another way of trying to measure or quantify how we're getting that information to the stakeholders, and in this case it's the geological information. What we're looking at is to reword this to fit more with our agency mission so that we have percent of local governances that have received our information to reduce future losses from geologic hazards. Number 11 is our customer MLRR, or our permitting customer satisfaction. We just started this, so we have one data point there, and we're pretty proud of that data point. If you note, it is at the 98th percentile. We were going to be happy if we had about 85%, so we're a little ahead of target. And I have to say that is because of the excellent staff and the strong field presence they have. And if you go to the back, the last two pages of the performance measure tab, it shows the results. I just want to quickly show you. It's the MLR. It's the customer satisfaction survey. So it really shows what we did. And the last page shows what the survey looked like. And I think it's important to note that we sent the survey along with the permittee's annual renewal form. So in other words, we're asking them for money and we're asking them to comment on the program at the same time.
And they had a fee increase.
Yeah. And they had a fee increase to deal with. And what we see is we sent on approximately 600 permittees. We had a return of 394, which gives us a 66% return, which in any survey is absolutely remarkable. And of that, you'll see that we had a very high percentage, again, bringing up to about the 98th percentile on satisfactory and above. And if folks are interested, we can happily supply you with some of those comments. We didn't put that in here, though, but we'll certainly make those available to anybody that'd like to have them. Now, that takes care of all the ones we have on the books now. If you move back to page 31 of the presentation, so we're in the front presentation part of the book. I'm going to quickly go through, explain what the short story is on the modifications and what those additions are. And if you want more detail on those additions, we can certainly do that. So on page 31, again, we have the key performance measures that roll up into the Oregon benchmark 67A. The first one, we want to change that to be specifically earthquake and landslide hazards and expand our stakeholder base. Number two, we want to specify the maps that are targeted for the communities and get rid of the mitigation part. We want to we want to concentrate on coastal erosion hazard characterization and get the landslide part out of there. Number four, we're going to delete because it's now redundant with one. Number five is no change. And we'd like to add would be number 14, which is the measurement of our tsunami inundation maps. Now, for the high-level outcomes for the agency goals, key performance measure 6, we're going to eliminate those percentages and measure the total acreages reclaimed, again, because that makes more sense. Number 11, this is our customer satisfaction. We'd like to add that one because we think that's very helpful, and we're actually going to be expanding on the surveys that we are that we're working on. Number 12, we would add percent of operators in our MLRR with active sites inspected annually by staff. So in other words,
Ernie Schaffer.
Excuse me. Thank you. Back to the measure 6, eliminate percentages. You're just going to report the total acreages reclaimed. Will there still be somewhere to go and look and find out how many acres have not been reclaimed? Because I think some of you would be interested in that.
Chair Krieger, Representative Schaffler, those data are not easily found, but I think it is something that we are working on. I'm looking to Gary for that. This has been something that's been discussed in the consensus group.
Mr. Chair, the reason I ask is if we can you could have a lot of acres and still have a large percentage out there that isn't done, and if we can say, look, we're reclaiming this, it's getting done, and this is how much was, and now this is how much there is after all this work.
Chair Krieger, Representative Sir Schaffler, we basically have that number now. We're tracking how many acres are reclaimed on a basically a daily basis. Whenever they reclaim, they reclaim. The number of acres currently being mined, that's a hard number. Approximately 20,000 acres are currently excavated for mining right now. The finer points that Vicki's talking about is right. We also have a number that would say how many acres are permitted right now that are not excavated. That's one that we have a little harder time with because we don't necessarily factor in when a mine is permitted, you have the extraction area where the gravel is that you're going to remove. Around that, you have setbacks, you have buffer areas, you have haul roads, you have stockpile areas. That's not excavated. It's in the operating permit. So we know how many acres, a very hard number on how many acres are excavated today, as of today, and we can, that's right around 20,000. We know how many are reclaimed. We don't necessarily have a real accurate number about how many are permitted. We could estimate that, but that's where we are.
Kind of like forestry, you know how many acres have been harvested, and then you know how many acres have been replanted.
Okay. Correct. Right.
So I mean, we got to go.
Right.
Welcome, Senator Shields.
Glad to be here, I guess.
Please stay alert. We want some good questions.
Right, yeah.
We'll continue on with the summary for the request for the performance measure modifications. We have that was key performance measure 12. Going on to the key performance measure 7, we'd like to reset the targets to incorporate our internal prioritization for data collection. And again, that was explaining how some of them may not be published, but they're still produced and used. Key performance measure 8 resets targets to incorporate our large digital mapping project that we just started a couple of years ago and really have no way of measuring our progress on that. Our key performance measure 9, we would redirect that measurement to determining if we're delivering the right kind of resource information or not. key performance measure 13, we would add a measurement for multi-year mapping projects. We have many of our projects are 3 to 5 years before we actually get a product out at the other end. It's difficult to measure that on a year, on an annual basis. And the key performance measure 10, define that measurement for how we're getting the information out in some type of quantifiable term that is linked to the percent of local governances receiving our geologic data for their. So that completes the performance measure discussion. I have one other quick sector to go through, and that is our prioritization. The LFO prioritization, and we'll go through that fairly quickly.
Mr. Chair, I believe that unless you've changed your tabs, that would be the performance measure tab.
Remember that tabs were switched, so
there we are, all these little sheets.
Yeah. All those nicely folded sheets that we made for everyone.
Mr. Siever, it'd be the first. Your normal chair is going to work with the agency through you and with you, looking about what they want to do, plus which of these need to be the performance measures that the agency needs within itself, and then which ones they're going to deliver out of your measure. Maybe you might define it as service or whatever.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think that their general interest was in some of the measures that link directly to the benchmark, the hazard mitigation, those kinds of measures they felt were important to report externally, that maybe there would be public interest in those type of measures. And certainly the measures with the mined land regulation and reclamation program, because it is kind of a more of a regulatory program, they thought that that most of those measures were okay. I think it was mainly the measures that you, I think, at one point kind of even characterized as internal measures, that revolving mostly around, you heard about the mapping and some of those other measures. I think that they were looking at maybe having the agency keep those internally because they help inform their progress on how they're doing on the mapping piece, but maybe that in fact those measures really in reality feed into the earlier measures that talk about the hazard mitigation and all those pieces, and maybe those would be a good kind of surrogate for having the particular percent of maps completed type measures in your performance measurement report. And we can get at the specifics, but I think that you can kind of see just from the layout we just went through probably which ones would they would be looking at, maybe just having the agency keep it internally.
Chair Krieger and Mr. Siebert and committee members, I see how just as we're speaking here, I can see how we can modify the as you say, not delete or get rid of them from our internal measurements because they are important. I think the one thing that I would ask is for these we maybe would keep for the external would be the community education or public that measurement of whether we're getting the things, because we can't do that if we haven't made the maps or done the characterizations or whatever. And so that may be the easiest way to try to quantify that. And we'll work with you on that. Thank you. We were asked, as all agencies were, to develop a prioritization of the agency in our programs and in our case would be our sections. And I have to admit, this is certainly the last thing we were doing. It was the most difficult part of this presentation was to discuss this. Before we actually go back and look at our cleverly folded worksheets, I wanted to just say a couple of things about the agency. This is page 32. As I said earlier, I suggest to you that our agency fulfills a unique state need. There aren't other agencies that are doing the same thing that we do. There are other agencies that have geologists. There are other agencies that have hydrologists, but they're working very internal to what they're doing. They're not necessarily producing information that's going to be used by anyone or everyone in the state. I suggest to you that we're the only agency that are regulating operation and reclamation of surface mineral resources. I also suggest to you that it's very difficult to try to prioritize around programs that have completely different goals when you're dealing with a certain resource like this. And I don't want to say an apple and an orange because I don't want to give you the idea they're completely different, but I was thinking maybe a grapefruit and a lime, something like that. And so just keep that in mind when we're talking about these. And again, it's difficult to compare what the rate of return or rate of on your investment when you're looking at a fee-based program and a grant-based program. So with that in mind, page 33, I know that people are interested in how we actually designed our prioritization criteria. That page gives you the instructions that we received from LFO up there in the sidebar box. And essentially what we did is if you look at the prioritization criteria at the section level, and that'll be for Program 1, because Program 2 really is one coherent program, but we were asked to split our sections out for Program 1. We looked at how does it satisfy our agency core missions or strategies? In other words, how does it fulfill the mandates we have? We looked at could that activity or that section be incorporated into another section? So is there a way to integrate to get a better return on our investment? We looked at whether we could contract that work out. In other words, is the work you do something that's pretty unique that you're not going to find outside contractors, or could you find a way to pass through to professional services or personal services? So again, how could we most serve Oregonians, or what's the best ROI? And we looked at what the funding streams are. You know, where do we have those highest values, or again, that ROI? And then when we were prioritizing our programs, which is program to program, I just asked two questions, and that is, does it fulfill an agency core mission or strategy? In other words, does it fulfill a mandate? And the second one is, can the agency survive without this program? In other words, if we're going to continue to serve the most Oregonians, if we remove that program, will we have an agency, and therefore will we be able to serve anyone? So those are tough questions. I talk a little bit about the impacts here in a minute, but if you turn back to your tab that says performance measures but is actually your prioritization, I would point you to the third fold-out spreadsheet. And that's actually, it's the department-wide priorities of the governor's recommended budget. So that essentially looks at the spreadsheet of how we prioritize across the department. Again, it'll say department-wide priorities. If you look in the far left column, as the column 1 and column 2 are priority ranked with highest priority first, we have the first column shows the ranking for the programs, and remember, we have two programs, so we have a 1 and we have a 2. And then the second column shows how we ranked those our sections within Program 1, which is the only one we split into sections. Program 2, that's really not applicable. So we ranked the geologic survey as 1, we ranked our MLRR as 2, and our ranking for our programs within the survey are our statewide mapping and minerals section 1, coastal field office 2, eastern Oregon section 3, southwest Oregon section 4, geohazard section 5, and our public education section 6. Now remember, this is based on those criteria that I described before. Can they be integrated into other programs? Can we contract out for what they do? Those type of things. I don't like even saying this, and I hate to have it on the record, I'll tell you that, but we did it, and there it is, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you have about it.
Any members, do you have any questions so far?
Well, that's pretty honest.
Kind of squirmed when she said it.
That's honesty.
Yeah, how about that?
If you look at the next page, which is the number 4 fold-out sheet, it actually then rolls into what will we mean, what's the 10% reduction, or you know, how would that actually look at, and after you rank it, it's determining what you're going to, or how can you reduce to hit that 10%. And if you, again, look at, you know, that's broken then into all funds. We're asked to do that for all funds, although I know general funds is really, I would suspect, is the highest priority here. Again, if you're looking at program divisions, if we look at our sixth rank, We would eliminate two positions in the Portland office in our education public ed, and we would then make some cuts also in our in-state travel to accomplish our what would be our 10% reduction to our general funds, which is about $294,000, $295,000. Other funds and federal funds, those would be eliminating some of our limitations and also removing some of the projects, some of the funded projects we're doing. There are impacts to those, and I certainly want to go on record of announcing what those would be. If we eliminate those positions in our public education, which is really that venue of getting that information that we are compiling, creating and compiling, if we eliminate those positions, and I'll remind you that we eliminated our editor position last time around, so we had to retool internal staff to be able to continue having an editor, we're not going to be able to get the information out ourselves. I mean, it's just the bottom line. We'll have to give up our services to the local governances and to the communities and those kind of things. We'll have to think of, and that means we'd have to think of other ways to do that. And
create the information, or you're developing as you go on, and you can't disseminate it. What would you exist for?
Chair Krieger, committee members, we could argue that we exist because it's important to have the information for someone to be able
at
to
some time.
At some time, yeah. Yes. But creating is also compiling and maintaining information is extremely critical, and it's part of the area where we end up having a lot of redundancy. If you don't maintain, it's just like your roads, if you don't maintain them, then you have to go back and fix them or replace them at some point. And actually, I like the road analogy because many times we go out and we develop programs where we compile a lot of information, but we don't put the money in there to be able to maintain that information in a usable way.
Senator Shields?
Yes, kind of building on your questions, Representative Krieger, bottom line in the corner of the page there, unable to maintain a viable agency. That is your bottom line. Right?
Yes, sir. I mean, Senator Chair Krieger, Senator Shields, yes.
You're saying three FTE lost, losing the two in Portland, not getting the information out. What are you doing? Why are we doing it? Sometimes we end up pretending around here, I think, because we got things and cut things until what's left can't do what we designed it to do, and we add mandates along the way. I mean, if you look at the history book on it, We every 5 years we added something new and amazing to what we're asking them to do. And
Mr. Seaman, co-chair budgets third, fourth, eighth month somewhere.
Hope to do something in that nature.
Mr. Chair, I believe that's roughly the timeline.
And then we'll be looking at real numbers. This is probably the outside of the bet, I would hope. And
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think that the co-chairs have all these reduction lists in front of them when they're trying to put together their co-chair budget, and I would say that they'd be looking at each and hopefully weighing each against the other and coming out to come up with a number for the
subcommittee. We have to get to.
Chair Krieger and committee members and Mr. Siebert, I appreciate where you're sitting at on that, and your seat is pretty hot too, and I realize that, and I hope that I've made a compelling argument and information here for to understand what we do and why we think that it's very important for the state.
Yeah, I just putting all the stuff together with other committees involved and listening to this to comment. I mean, we're doing these performance measures. They're directed to the Oregon benchmarks. Some are supposed to somehow be tied or and yet, going back to my first comment, is that the overall circle of prosperity that I've seen in other committees that comes out under Oregon Shines is backwards. So we're building all these performance measures into the benchmarks on a premise that's backwards. I mean, and what I think the question we ought to be asking, and I'm going to present this to the co-chairs at some point, is that the first thing we ought to really be looking at, and it goes back to something Representative Schaefer said all the time,
we have to provide opportunities for Oregonians. If we provide opportunities for Oregonians, that leads into good public schools, that leads into good, you know, everything else. But the way the circle of prosperity is goes the other way. It goes, we want, I don't know what it's called, quality of life. That will provide something that turns into good schools or revenue, enough revenue. The thing that's broken in our system is we don't have enough revenue. I mean, in every committee that we're involved in, there's not enough revenue. So we're doing this backwards. I mean, I think we've got to go the other way. Provide opportunities for Oregon. And that ought to be one of the big performance measures. How do you provide opportunity for Oregonians? I mean, for that's harmless time to look at it.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to comment on the performance measure piece and what the Senator said about the benchmarks, and I want to hopefully I can clear up a misconception. Is at least in our office, we're trying to make sure that the Oregon benchmarks, while they're important and we keep them in mind with what we're doing, they don't drive the process that we're doing in these subcommittees and that we're doing as part of this work. We want to make sure that agencies have measures of their performance that make sense to them. And where those measures then make a logical link to a benchmark, which you can see in this agency because there is a specific benchmark that they even help provide the information for, then that agency should link that and say that we realize that benchmark's out there and that we link to that. But we like to think of it more as kind of maybe a bottom-up driven process. While some others may think that the importance is to make sure that every performance measure links to a benchmark, we're not interested in that. At least in our office, what we've tried to push is if it makes a logical sense, then that's what we should be doing. But this whole process is about getting measures that make sense to you, provide information to the committee for the decisions they have to make.
Thank you. Mr. Schaffer, are you happy on it? Good. Got it all done?
Chair Krieger, committee members, I, if you want to take a look at page 36, you will, but I've said it in about four different ways already today about what we have sustained as cuts through the last time and where we sit right now and what the impact is. And I very much appreciate your interest and your good questions and the discussions today, and look forward to coming back and having the difficult discussion with the last 10 pages of the presentation when we get down into the budget.
I think Mr. Siebert's point about the performance measures and your concern about when we get all said and done, you're talking dollars and the ability for Oregon to have an economy that grows to provide the services that people want. And somehow we got to connect it all together. And that's not a partisan issue, Mr.
There's no problem with the services people want. It's that they don't want to pay for the services that they want.
We have to get the funding for it and prioritize. Mr. Siebert, what have we got tomorrow?
Day off. It's Friday.
Mr. Chair, that saves
me. We want to meet tomorrow.
Well, you'll have to come to Corvallis. That's where my committee is. I chair this is relevant. I chair a committee on emergency preparedness. Our general government committee in the Senate, and in fact, we're going to even have a little demonstration of the wave machine that simulates tsunamis.
Mr. Chair.
So Mr. Krieger, you ought to come to that and see just how tsunamis work.
We'll probably be working here. What have you got here now?
I have the science of predicting tsunamis, earthquakes. Here in this science, where is that getting any better, or is this just impossible to ever do?
Chair Krieger, Representative Schaffler, the science of forecasting or predicting some type of a catastrophic hazard like that, there are many different sciences out there. There's a lot of folks that are working on that. I think some of them may be getting closer, some of them not. Some natural hazards we're much better at. Hurricanes we're getting better at, although when the things take a right-hand turn at the last minute, we always, they have that. Volcanic eruptions, we're much better at being able to tell when things are going to happen as long as we have the volcanoes monitored. If they're not monitored, then you don't know what's going to happen.
I've got a guy standing there looking at the smokes.
Yeah.
And then I want to make one more comment. I wish the Senator was still here, but There, it's true. Some people want these services and don't want to pay for them. There's also people that want a strong economy but don't want to do anything to help create that strong economy. So, and that's what the state's full of folks like that, these conflicting opinions and philosophies that just simply don't add up.
And drive you crazy.
Drive me nuts. Forgive me. I'm taking up your time.
Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you so much, sir.
And we're adjourned. Thank you.